Happy last day of June, everybody. Hey, I'm Larry Jacobs. This is Pre-K-12 Education Talk Radio. Thanks so much for being with us today. Again, this last day of June, and July looks at us, July 4th, etc. We want everybody to have a safe July. So it's been a pretty good June over here at Education Talk Radio, even with the pandemic and the social justice. We've done a lot of talking about all these wonderful things and all these terrible things and how they relate to schools. All right, and I don't know where I got wonderful out of there. That one slipped out. All right, these terrible things. And today we're going to end with a bang, end June with a bang. I've got Dr. Ashley Rogers-Berner, and Ashley is the Deputy Director of the Johns Hopkins Institute for Education Policy. She's also an Associate Professor of Education at JHU School of Education. She is an expert. She's the author of a book which is so important. I'd love to do a show just focusing on this, Ashley, called Pluralism in American and American Public Education, No One Way to School. That's from 2017, Ashley Berner's book. And she combines an expertise in education, all right, with an expertise in history. And it's really interesting. It's going to be a great show today. We're going to talk about school culture, why it matters, and how it improves, and how we improve it. I'll bring Ashley on in just a second. We're going to archive the show at education-talkradio.org, education-talkradio.org. That's our home website for this show, and we put a new schedule up there every Saturday. You can go over, check it out. We also have every show we've ever done since 2011 archived over there. It's under an icon called Past Shows. And we have some interesting news and events that you might want to check out there as well. In addition, we are incredibly concerned about equity and access. And as most of you know, we have a website geared exclusively to that. That's a website that is addressed at ace-ed.org. ace-ed.org. And that ACED is actually an acronym. It's for the American Consortium for Equity in Education. We invite you to join. Everything we do over there is free. You'll be able to see everything that we have in terms of the wonderful editorial, etc., that people send in. We want your voice heard over there. Our magazine, AC&E, Equity and Access Pre-K-12, is over there, our official online journal. Just click through on that icon, you'll see some wonderful things, including some good information, great information, okay, from Johns Hopkins as you open the magazine, and that's about their new report on school culture, which is why we're going to talk to Dr. Berner, who was responsible for that in just a couple of minutes. So that's ace-ed.org. Check that out. Join our consortium for educators, pre-K-12. Everything we do over there is free. And now I have the pleasure of introducing you to the one and only, all the way, I think, from Baltimore, somewhere in Maryland, Ashley Rogers-Berner. Hi, Ashley. It's Larry, as you know. How you doing?
Very well. Thanks so much for having me on your show today.
You are welcome here anytime, Dr. Berner. I got big news for you, and I hope you enjoy yourself enough that you come back 100 million times. That would be wonderful. Right. And actually,
you,
I got to tell you, you are really, truly an expert. And one of the things, I'm a history teacher when I was teaching. Okay. And I love that you have a degree in modern history. And I think you're able to look at everything from a historian's point of view and see why school culture and pluralism really matters. And I just said, for the sake of your book, which again is called Pluralism in American and American Public Education, just put school culture and pluralism together. Then we'll get into what school culture is.
Okay, well, wonderful. I do have all the degrees in history. I, too, have taught history. I've taught at many different levels, from pre-K all the way up to now graduate school. And
by the way, I have to say you're very ecumenical, because I know you taught Jewish preschool, and then you also, if I'm right, taught Presbyterian school. Am I correct?
Close. I taught at a Jewish preschool, and then I taught in an Episcopal secondary school. That's where I taught comparative religion and ethics. And then I've also taught it at an open university in Louisiana, where I taught big classes on Western Civ and American history. And I now teach in the doctoral program at Hopkins. But yes, putting together pluralism in school culture. So what pluralism essentially is a different way of structuring public education, Pluralism is a structure in which the government funds and regulates but doesn't necessarily deliver education. So this is by far the norm in democratic countries around the world. England, the Netherlands, Indonesia, Israel, Sweden, most democracies don't consider one kind of school to be legitimate. They fund Jewish schools, Catholic schools, Montessori schools, socialist schools, and non-denominational schools on equal footing. And the reason why that, let me just add that our country used to do this. We used to fund all different of schools, and I'd be delighted to talk with you.
We're going to have that conversation, I promise. Let me put that on hold.
Let me put that on hold because it's a fascinating history in its own right. And it has real consequences for how we debate education these days in our country. But the
You're going to hear from me later today. We're going to schedule that show. I can't wait for that. So go ahead. Continue your thought.
I can't wait. But the point is that pluralistic systems build distinctive cultures into their design. So the premise is that schools can't be neutral on with respect to values, and that there are different ways to conduct pedagogy. You know, you've got progressive pedagogy, traditional pedagogies, you've got different children's needs, and you've got different religious beliefs, philosophical beliefs, whether secular, religious, Marxist, whatever, and that therefore, it's important for democracies to support different kinds of schools and hold them all accountable. So that kind of research is what really took me to this notion of school culture and why it's so important. And how do we translate what we've learned from international models into the United States in a way that works for district schools, charter schools, private schools, and so forth?
But it's not a one-size-fits-all school culture. When you say school culture, or maybe it is. I shouldn't say it that way.
Define school culture.
Yeah, give us a good definition. What do you mean?
So, Dr.
Berner, what do you mean? You speak for all school culture. Go ahead.
You are
the expert, so go ahead. Ashley.
When we talk about school culture, we don't just mean a school that's friendly, a school where there's no bullying, a school that's orderly. We mean rather a school in which the mission of the school, what it sets out to do, is very, very clear. It's clear to all the stakeholders, students, teachers, parents, administrators, they're pulling in the same direction. And furthermore, the mission really matters. It translates into the...
Ashley? Where are you? What happened?
Education.
I couldn't hear you. The last minute or so, I couldn't hear you. Just your voice disappeared, literally.
Probably because I'm pacing, because that's what I do.
That's what happens. I understand. I want to hear every word. So go back over the last minute or so. Yeah.
All right. So strong school culture, we mean a school in which the mission of the school and what it aspires to do, what it thinks it's doing, is clear to everyone. Whether it's clear to the parents, it's clear to the teachers, the students, the admins, and most importantly, that mission translates into how the school is run and operating. Mm-hmm. So let me give you a sense of how this can go well and how it can go off. First of all, no school does mission perfectly. There's just no such thing. There's always room for continuous improvement. But a school that's aligned with its mission would be, suppose it is a Jewish school that holds that all students are made in the image of God, for example, and that therefore the discipline is handled with respect. There's not a punitive kind of approach to any child, no matter how disruptive the child is. And this was, by the way, true to my experience teaching in a Jewish preschool. The same is true if you have a district school that aspires to get all kids into higher education or a career pathway and actually delivers on a strong curriculum for all kids. And instead of segregating by race or actually, you know, giving some kids a less rigorous curriculum and so forth enables all kids to thrive intellectually. That would be mission alignment. An example of a disconnect between mission and practices: if a school, say a private school, has a strong honor code, and you know it no cheating, no stealing, and so forth, but a child whose parents are trustees of the school gets away with all of that stuff. That's a disconnect between the mission and the practices.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
You know, right. By contrast, you know, a school like Chicago Public Schools put international baccalaureate into some of its very low performing urban schools, and nobody thought they could do it, that it would have any effect. But because all of those students were challenged and the teachers believed they could really do it, there was a 40% greater chance of going to college. So that's an example of where the intention carried out and how students were treated and the outcomes. So that's what we mean by school culture. We mean something that is distinctive and clear and practiced. And
practiced, if I may. That's the key word is practiced. But there's an interesting thing. This is semantics. Okay, I want to talk to you about that. Then we'll get into the new report from Johns Hopkins. But I want to ask you this. We call this school culture, and that word school is singular, all right? Yet you were talking about, and we can go to any bigger district, but let's say Chicago, Baltimore, where Johns Hopkins is, Boston, Philadelphia, where I went to school, okay? If we do this school by school within a district, let's use Philly, my old school district, okay? If we do this school by school, the culture has to be district-wide and equal across the board. There are good neighborhoods, if I may, and bad neighborhoods, richer neighborhoods, poorer neighborhoods in Philadelphia and every city, okay? So the schools in the better neighborhood have a different culture than the schools in the poor neighborhood, just as an example, all right? So when we say school culture in a larger district, do we really mean district culture?
Well, I think, no, actually it's both and. So
okay.
One of the interesting things, of course, there is, you're exactly right, there is variability within a school sector or a system. So there's variability. So even if the district has an aim that is singular for, say, all of its high schools. And what we'll see when we actually look under the hood at what it feels like for students and teachers and parents, we will find variability. In fact, that's what we find with our school culture survey work.
Mm-hmm.
But the goal there is to be able to say to district leaders and the principals, here's the variability. This is where, as a district, you have big wins. This is where, as a district, you have real challenges. Maybe it's across the board. But then you really want to look at the school level and say, okay, in this school, suppose Latino parents feel disenfranchised. That school has an opportunity to work on this thing. Or another school, and I will tell you this is not uncommon, high-performing, high SES school may have great academic outcomes, but there's a very high percentage of kids who talk about the cheating that goes on in the school. That's a different kind of challenge for that school. So whatever the school sector, whether it's Catholic or Jewish or district or charter, even within the same system, there's going to be variability. And that's, you want to see that so that you can really support those leaders and those communities in improving on whatever measures they want to, you know, select. You don't want to, you know. So the point is there's always room to grow and to improve, and it's just important to know the landscape.
And what's the difference? And I'm just going to use, I'll use the best, Finland, okay? That's simple to understand, okay? Mm-hmm. What's the difference between school culture, okay, and Finland is a democracy. That's why I'm going with it. Democracy, Finland, and the United States. I have this feeling their school culture is better, and I admit they're a bit more homogeneous, that a bit in air quotes, okay? But when you look at other democracies,
When we look at other democracies, and here Finland pertains, but there are schools, there are countries and systems that I would say are even more apropos to the United States because they have the same levels of immigration and the same. They don't have the income variability that we do. No other country has this, but there are school systems that have as high percentage of immigrants that we do, first generation kids, and that also successfully close achievement gaps. And I would say the difference is school culture, as you pointed out, is not a thing. It's not one thing, but it functions in a similar way. So the difference between our system and places like the Netherlands, the UK, even Finland, they structure their school systems to incentivize distinctive school cultures. So the Netherlands funds 36 different kinds of schools, and it's built into the design. And they assume that distinctive school cultures, distinctive from one another, is really a good. As a matter of fact, for decades, the Netherlands never would compare entire school sectors to one another. They don't tend to do that. You know, we fight a whole lot about charters versus districts, and we have this combative attitude in the States. Other countries don't do that because they assume schools should be distinctive in positive ways. Obviously, they don't want, I mean, nobody funds intentionally, you know, Aryan nation schools or something like that. I mean, but they also evaluate all of those schools in the same metrics. So they will want, so for example, the Netherlands and the UK are my favorites because their independent inspectorate, it's called Ofsted in the UK, it's the most famous one probably, had been operating for more than 200 years in some cases. And they assess schools on their own terms. They look at the alignment of the culture to what the kids are saying, the kids are experiencing, and so forth. And they also look at the academic results. They visit classrooms. And so their assumption is that these schools will have different claims that they make about the human person, about the best pedagogy, but that they will all deliver on academic results and, you know, children's thriving and well-being. So
The kids, this is interesting. Again, I want to get back into the JHU survey, but just as a question, okay, let's take the Netherlands, do they expect a graduate at the end, do they expect them all to be the same, that they all have the same learning when all said and done?
They expect that they have all been required to learn the same content. And this is, again, very important. Alberta, Canada, which is one of the highest performing school systems in the world, Alberta funds Catholic, Jewish, secular, Inuit. I mean, they fund First Nations schools and homeschoolers, but they require all those schools to learn the kids to learn the same content. And what's really interesting about this is, you know, we know from research that a intellectually rigorous curriculum is an important independent factor in closing the achievement gaps. I mean, this is an equity issue. This is an equity issue for all of us. And, you know, having the high quality, intellectual, challenging curriculum that all kids have to learn. And what these other countries tend to do is they'll say, look, your ethos as a school, we're going to fund schools with different ethos, but we're going to require you to teach the same content. You can teach it through different lenses. Mm-hmm. So if you're in you want your kids to go to a secular, enlightenment-oriented, rationalistic school, you're going to be learning about religious beliefs and critiquing them through your lens, but you're going to know it. You're going to know what other people believe. They all require comparative religion and ethics every year for all kids. If you go to a, so that would be for a secular school. If you go to a Jewish school, you're going to learn about citizenship and Alberta education, but you're going to be looking at it through the lens of Tikkun Olam. So you're going to be able to bring in those worldview components to make sense of the content. And then at the end of every year, in most cases, in some cases it's every other year, there's an exit exam that in the Netherlands it's every year. All the kids have to take a content-specific exit exam.
Hmm.
So they're not just doing disaggregated skills. If they're supposed to learn about the Greeks and Romans in first grade, they have to be assessed on that. And this is the way that schools are evaluated. But it's also, I think what I love about this is content-rich assessments kind of creates this virtuous circle. It puts an
mm-hmm.
equal burden on kids.
I lost you again for a minute. In our country,
the assessments that we undertake, which, I mean, I'm in favor of assessments. We need to know how kids are doing and how schools are doing. This is an equity issue as well. But in this country, it's tended to play out in a punitive way against teachers or against, you know, low-performing
yeah.
schools. But in those
yeah.
other countries, it is, the onus is not just on teachers and schools, it's on the students to actually learn the material and demonstrate that you can do it. So it's actually a very good model.
Without question, it's a very good model. And it changes the whole pedagogy of what we're trying to accomplish here. And I think it also assumes
that there's a democratic imperative that we have some kind of shared conversation in a democracy, that it's really not okay for some kids to learn about the way governments function, the reason why we had a revolution in this country. It's important for students to understand the Civil War and its long tail into the 21st century. And
yeah.
what we know from, you know, the Pew Forum that has released data that suggests that only 30% of American adults know that stuff. Well, this is an equity issue, and it's important for our democracy. So the content of education really matters, and our country has veered off. We veered off in the early 20th century. But that's another conversation, Larry. It's not about school culture.
I could listen to you all day, really and truly. I love this stuff. And your thoughts on it are just amazing. Let me ask you this. Okay, let's go back. Johns Hopkins just did a survey, okay, on school cultures. All right? Now, we all heard what you just said. Okay, what was learned from the survey? And by the way, everybody, if you go over to ace-ed.org and open up our magazine, you'll see this big informational piece about how you can get the survey, etc. Okay, we'll talk about ways to get it, but it is rather important and it's great stuff. Okay, why'd you do the survey and kind of what did you learn? Just go ahead.
Well, first of all, it's not just a survey that we delivered and are now reporting on. It's not a report even. It's a resource that can be accessed by any kind of school. It's an active school culture survey that we partner with, you know, for the foreseeable future with districts, charters, private schools, and so forth to assess school culture over time. So that's what it is. When we administer the survey, and I'll talk about how we created it in a second, but when we work with partners, whether it's a district or an archdiocese, and we help them administer the survey to parents, teachers, admins, and students, secondary school students, then we put the data in our highly protected firewall Johns Hopkins database. They can access it. And we work with them as they access their data. What does it mean? What do we do about it? And then year on year, they can track how their school cultures may have changed based on the interventions that they undertook. So it's an ongoing project. In fact, we hope this will continue for decades. So let me tell you why we created it. So as you know, there are a lot of school culture or school, more commonly called school climate surveys in this country.
Right.
A lot
right.
of, and there are a lot of them, and many of them are really, really good. So but we wanted to know, based on the international research, if there was an opportunity to create a new model that drew on a lot of the strong points that other surveys in this country have, but that also investigated other domains of school culture that were left unexamined in all of the school culture surveys in our country. And
like what?
So we are,
like what?
Well,
that was
well,
left unexamined.
Well, I think the two most important to me personally are this notion of mission clarity and mission alignment with practices. And the second would be this notion of civic formation. There are certain things that schools can do or not that schools can do that have a long-term positive independent effect on civic behaviors. Now, what do we mean by civic behaviors?
Yeah.
So political scientists, and I'm citing David Campbell's work. He's a genius political scientist at Notre Dame. But they political scientists, when they talk about democratic outcomes and civic outcomes, they're talking mainly about four things. The first is civic knowledge. Do you know how governments work? Do you know why we have a democracy? Do you know what other countries have instead? You know, that kind of thing. So it's basic civic knowledge. Number two, civic skills. Do you know how to interpret legislation? Do you know how to read op-eds? Do you know how to write your congressperson? Those kinds of skills. Do you know how to be involved as a citizen? The third is the habit of civic engagement, volunteering, voting, but it's far beyond voting. It's about your role in civil society. And then the fourth, and really critical, is this notion of civil tolerance. So do you know how to articulate your own opinions clearly and respond to someone else's opinions without demeaning, dehumanizing, but actually engaging? And do you affirm their right to have different beliefs? Now, all those four things, that cluster, is what political scientists look at when they're trying to assess the school's impact on those things in adulthood. And it's fascinating. And So the interesting thing is, this is one of the reasons why democracies fund public education in the first place. When you look at the debate from the 18th century all the way up till now about why we should fund public education as countries, it's not first and foremost about individual opportunity, although it is that, but it's really about our common democratic project. It's about raising able citizens. So if schools are failing with this, we need to know. Well, the interesting thing is that most democracies survey schools for their capacity to build long-term civic behaviors. The United States doesn't. Our NAEP scores are really about individual student knowledge and so forth. They are really important. And by the way, they're really concerning, but they're not set up. They're not designed to assess what's going on in those same schools. You know, they can't. It's not what they're set up to do. So part of what we did at Johns Hopkins
Let me stop you for a second. When did we lose our way on this? Because I agree with you, and I haven't thought about it as deeply as you have, obviously, okay? Mm-hmm. But, you know, public education was set up to create an informed citizenry, okay? And, in fact, the Electoral College, if I may, was created because they were worried that the citizenry at the time of the Constitution was not going to be a well-informed citizenry. And for our experiment in democracy, they had to be. Unfortunately, we never changed that electoral college system, which should have changed about 2 zillion years ago, okay, when public education took hold. But somehow, okay, Ash, if I may, we have lost our way from that initial foundation. And when did we do that? Was it always lost, or was there a point in time when we actually really started to bend away from it?
Well, it's a good question. It's a good point, and there are lots of different factors in this. And I don't know that there's any evidence that there was ever a golden age as far as this goes. But I will say that when the first sort of external evaluation of American culture was Alexis de Tocqueville, who was a Frenchman who wheeled around the early Republic in 1830s in America. Remember, nobody knew that democracy would be sustainable. It was the world's first modern democracy.
And we still don't know. And if I may, we still don't know a republic if we can keep it. Okay, that's simple.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And one of the things he found was this voluntary civil society orientation of Americans. And the second was their knowledge of the democratic institutions. And so that we have lost that. We've lost it in part, I think, in terms of our educational system, I think in part because we departed from, first and foremost, we departed from a shared intellectual curriculum in the early 20th century, and we moved to a skills-based education. And this was intentional, and it has had terrible effects on our equity. It has had terrible effects on our ability to create an equitable opportunity for kids, for all kids, and it has had a deleterious effect on our citizenship outcomes. If you look at our NAEP scores and you see that only 12% of 12th graders are proficient in history and geography, this is criminal. I mean, this is a real problem, and it's because of the academic curriculum. It's not being delivered systematically. So we now have generations of American adults who haven't experienced that kind of education that we know is important for civic knowledge and civic skills. But
I
think also
actually. You're like on you're such on target to the way I think about this. Okay, I love this.
Well, that's validating. Well, but I think also with civics, there have been some real disillusionment and disputes about whose history, whose version of history should be delivered. And a lot of this happened in the Vietnam era, and it happened strangely. I mean, a lot of Western countries, a lot of developed democracies were starting to go through some appropriate soul searching about the way they comported themselves vis-a-vis, ethnic and racial minorities and international diplomacy and so forth. So the disillusionment caused perhaps an appropriate pulling back from a more jingoistic citizenship formation, the kind of nativism that we can talk about separately. But nothing replaced it. Nothing replaced it. And, so this is what our institute spends a lot of time doing as well. We work on school culture, but we also work on the academic curriculum. And what do kids need to know for democratic purposes? I just got off of a ministerial appointment in Alberta, Canada, to look at their curriculum and their assessments. And the social studies curriculum is unbelievable, what they have to know. I mean, I think I just find myself saying, how can we expect our young people we need their voice in the political discourse, but many of them don't know where, if you talk about Middle Eastern policies, they don't know where those countries are. They don't know why they're important. They don't know, what Japan's major exports are or what system of government Canada has. I mean, this is a content issue.
Oh, it's unbelievable. I'll just use this as the example. About a year ago, one of the folks on I never watch it, but the Fox and Friends show in the morning, the woman who was on it, I don't even know who she is, said, and I almost quote, I'm paraphrasing, that the reason we were in World War II was so we could defeat the communists in Japan. This is where we are. When the biggest morning show in America, a news show, their host is saying that the communists in Japan were the cause of World War II.
Yeah.
And thankfully, we defeated them. And that was, so you, when you say people don't have the knowledge, I just read somewhere where something like 23% of people can name the three branches of government.
That's right. That's
okay?
right.
And you
right.
are dead on right, you know, with the school culture. We have to get back, okay, to what it originally intended for. Because if you don't do that, democracy, and certainly Republican form of democracy, Republican being the
right.
generic term, it doesn't work.
Yes.
It's based
well, it,
on,
well,
yeah, it doesn't work.
Well, that's right. It needs knowledge and it needs practice. And so to your earlier question about what we've added into our school culture survey, this too is based on the political science, not just in this country, but around the world, that shows that one of the early indicators or one of the predictors, one of the factors in civil tolerance, in the capacity to become a young person and then an adult with civil tolerance, is something that we call the open classroom climate. And an open classroom climate doesn't mean a free-for-all. It means rather a place where multiple viewpoints are presented coherently and students are taught how to respect different viewpoints. If
mm-hmm.
students don't
Hello.
Learn how to do that, if students don't learn how to do that in secondary school, where are they going to learn it?
You
know,
got that
colleges,
right.
And
right.
what we and we know that this happens very seldom in American classrooms. There are a lot of reasons why teachers shy away from having
right.
these conversations. There are a lot of reasons, many of them very understandable. And yet most countries, when they administer the international assessment, so there's one international assessment that we used to participate in that we no longer do. And it's the International Civic and Citizenship Education Study, the ICCS.
I don't know that one.
Yeah, we haven't participated since 1999. But they actually report on the open classroom climate, whether multiple
wow.
viewpoints are – and they have found that the outcomes of the open classroom climate – having a positive effect on civic outcomes that has held stable across 40 years of their administering surveys. So we built some of those questions into our school culture survey.
It's really important. No, wait a minute. I've got to ask you a couple of things. This eHarmony has worked out great, Ashley. I think we're a match, and I want to continue this, but we're running out of time for this. Okay. And what are you doing at 9 o'clock on Thursday morning? Can we continue this conversation? I'm serious. What are you doing?
I think so. Let me check my calendar. I can't look at my calendar while I'm on the phone with you. So
yeah, and I think this relationship's going to work out great. Whatever you do, don't tell my wife. Okay. And I think this is going to be great. For the next date at 9 in the morning on Thursday, okay? Because I got a lot more I want to talk to you about. I love listening to you.
Okay. All right.
But this is super stuff. I'll send you a reminder of this as soon as we're done the show. So we'll do 9 a.m. on Thursday morning. But where should people go just to get a hint for it now? We'll continue then. But where do you want people to go?
Yeah, so look at our website. Just Google Johns Hopkins Institute for Education Policy. I can give
right.
you the it's edpolicy.education.jhu.edu, or you can write me directly, Ashley.Berner, that's B-E-R-N-E-R, Ashley.Berner@jhu.edu. Happy to talk to people about it, happy to give presentations. It's what I love.
It's really important, and boy, are you terrific, and that's why I want to continue this sooner rather than later. So 9 o'clock on Thursday works perfect.
I'll try.
Okay?
Thank you, Barry.
Okay, I got to tell you, because this is just such great stuff, and it's
thank
so
you.
Important. You know, we're talking the equity stuff. We're talking the school culture. I mean, it's just – and civics – okay? And the whole idea of what in hell is our school supposed to be doing and how can we make changes for the positive? I got to say something, okay? With this pandemic, and we'll talk about that, with this pandemic, although it's a horrible thing, so many people dead, now we've got the challenge of social justice since Mr. Floyd died, okay?
But yes.
This is, now we have an opportunity.
Yeah.
Okay. This is, it, as bad as it is an opportunity. Suddenly everybody seems to be rethinking everything. So we're going to have Dr.
Yes.
Berner lead the charge here. Thursday, we have a date. Thursday morning. Okay. Dutch treat.
No.
Dutch treat. Okay. Thursday morning, 9 a.m. Okay.
And remind me to talk about the racial justice issue with respect
Got
to
it.
School culture.
Got
okay.
it. I'm just saving
Thanks,
the sheet. Now, you'll hear from me in just a few minutes. Thank you, Ashley Berner. Thank you.
Thanks. Bye.
Okay. Talk to you again in a few minutes. Bye. Okay. So I have a date. You can join in, everybody, 9 o'clock on Thursday morning. All right. With Dr. Berner, Ashley Roger Berner's Deputy Director of the Johns Hopkins Institute for Education Policy. You can just Google that, Johns Hopkins Institute for Education Policy, edpolicy.education.jhu.edu, but I'll put that up on the website when you listen to the show again or listen to it for the first time, and we'll continue the conversation. Then we'll archive at education-talkradio.org and tweet it out at EduTalkRadio like we always do. We'll talk again on Thursday morning. In the meantime, we have more shows to do tomorrow and Thursday. We actually have two shows, all right? So check it all out, education-talkradio.org, and also go over to ace-ed.org and learn more about equity than you ever wanted to know. Okay? It's a great website, ace-ed.org. I'm Larry Jacobs. Thanks, Ashley.